Good morning. I hope you're all awake because Max is going to start in a few minutes. Otherwise, I recommend quickly getting another coffee. As Sita said, my name is Amit Eisenträger. I'm at the end of the second year of my PhD in Oxford, and I work together with Ian Sobey and also his former student Benedict Wirth, who is now in Cambridge, in Bonn, and Marek Schofnicker from the Department of Clinical Neurosciences in Cambridge. And we work on multifluid poloelastic modeling of the CSF infusion test. I know that by now you're all experts on hydrocephalus and CSF flow. I will nevertheless quickly recap and especially point out the bits and pieces that go into our model, and then consider two different kinds of models. First one is a compartment type model, in which we consider the whole of the CSF as one compartment and relate its pressure with its volume via an ordinary differential equation. And the second one is the advertised poroelastic model, or the multi-fluid poroelastic model. But I will first start with a one-fluid poroelastic model, which is the standard theory to explain what's going on, and then show you how to extend that to two fluids. And then in the end, I'll draw some conclusions and show you the plans we have for the future. So, again, CSF is this water-like fluid surrounding the brain and the spinal cord. So, it is mostly produced by the choroid plexus. It's mostly produced by the choroid plexuses in the ventricles, flows from there through the aqueduct of Sylvius, but also partly through the porous brain tissue, as we believe, and then towards the subarachnoid space, where it is reabsorbed into venous blood. It is important to note that, on the one hand, the production from arterial blood is an active secretion procedure, so it happens at a fairly constant rate, independent of CSF pressure or arterial blood pressure, whereas the absorption via the arachnoid villi is dependent on the pressure difference between CSF and venous blood. And also the arachnoid villi work as a one-way valve, so fluid exchange only happens into that one direction. Furthermore, all this flow is not steady but oscillatory because the skull is rigid, in an adult at least, so when blood is pumped, arterial blood is pumped into the head with each heartbeat, other fluid needs to leave. That is partly venous blood and partly CSF going down and up the spine into the lumbar sac. CSF, as you've heard, is related to abnormalities in CSF flow. And one of the standard tests that is done in the diagnosis of hydrocephalus and in the choice of treatment, whether to shunt or not, is the so-called infusion test. During this test, additional fluid is injected into the CSF space at a constant rate, either into the ventricles or via a lumbar puncture. And at the same time, the intracranial pressure is measured. And from the rise of the CSF during the infusion and the fall after the infusion, one can get information about the CSF dynamics of that patient. Here we have one such data set. The upper graph is arterial blood pressure, which is also measured simultaneously, usually via a finger cuff, and the lower graph, the intracranial pressure. In this case, the infusion starts after about 5 minutes and ends after about 20 minutes of the test. Now, finger compartment model. What's basically happening is that the change in volume equals what's flowing in minus what's flowing out. So we have change in volume, which we can write as dVdP times dPdT, so compliance C of P times the change in pressure equals inflow minus this pressure-dependent outflow. The inflow either is just the production rate, assumed to be constant, or the production rate plus the infusion rate. Now, in standard models, the compliance is used to have a form like this with an elasticity E and a pressure difference P minus, and the pressure difference P minus PR, where PR is a reference pressure, which we don't really know what it means. Now, if we consider the steady state of the system, this would be zero, and under normal conditions, it would be zero, and that would be just a constant pressure, P minus baseline pressure, PB minus PR, and this is the production rate. So then we get an estimate for the production rate from the baseline pressure and can change our equation, getting rid of the production rate, but adding the new parameter baseline pressure. This also gives us an easy way to write the initial condition, because we can just say, well, at the beginning, the pressure is normal baseline pressure. So in total, we have now four parameters defining this model, which we can try and fit to clinical data. Now the question is, why should a compliance have this form? Why does it have to be 1 over elasticity times P minus reference pressure? So we just generalize this a tiny bit and allow it to have a different power here. Also, the units change a bit, but in general, this just translates into having a pressure-dependent elasticity. And now we have five parameters defining the model. The standard model, which is the same as setting n to 1, is kind of easy because you can get an analytic solution, which doesn't look very nice, if you ask me, but it does work. And we have highly nonlinear dependencies on these input parameters. The extended model we can only solve numerically, and that is for me done by MATLAB, just ODE45. I've tried to tweak the parameters a bit to make the least squares fit a bit better behaved. So I just define scale parameters, and then I want to minimize the least squares function. It's nice to know that we have about 30 measurement points per second over a time of 30 to 45 minutes. So we have of the order of 50,000 measurement points in there. The gray graph is the same plot as we've seen before. And on top of that, three different plots of this model we've just seen. The first one in black, which is hardly visible, is with a standard model, so we set n to be 1. The second one in red is where we also look for the optimal power n, which now gives us a value of 7.8. And the third plot in blue is where we used a different value for n, which seemed reasonable from other simulations that we've done. We set that to be 0.5. Now, unfortunately, those graphs all look pretty much the same. Even after the infusion, which we didn't include into the least squares fit, because sometimes the patient was set up or CSF was tapped because of side effects. So we only considered this bit, but still, at the end, they only differ ever so slightly. On the other hand, the parameters are all over the place. The elasticity ranges from 0.02 to 0.91. Reference pressure here is negative, which doesn't really make sense physically. And also the estimate of the production rate, which we can get from reference pressure, baseline pressure, and resistance, is pretty much all over the way. The value cited in the literature of 450 milliliters per day would mean 0.3 milliliters per minute. So these two look kind of reasonable. That one is way out of everything. It is not quite surprising that we get the same baseline pressure, because that should just be the average of the first pressure measurement before the infusion starts. And also the resistance is consistent, because it is just defined by the increase in pressure in total. Surprisingly, we also, if we integrate inflow minus outflow over the time until the end of the infusion, we get an estimate of how much additional fluid is in the brain, or how much must have replaced blood or must have gone into the spine. And these numbers also are pretty much the same despite those very different production rates. If you look at different data sets, you get a pretty similar picture. We obtain, written down the power, which is on the one hand always 1, which is the standard model, and the other ones range from 0.55, 4.1, 5.8, up to 8.6. So all the other parameters are going to be completely different. But nevertheless, the plots are pretty much on top of each other in all of these cases. So when you do parameter estimation with these square fits or the like, we should be careful and think, if my model would be slightly different, could I still get the same information, and which information can I trust and which I can't? So instead, it's nicer to consider biomechanical models, because then you can, at least in theory, just measure the mechanical parameters, and then everything follows from physics. So instead, we consider the brain as a poroelastic material. To make it easy and solvable for now, we just consider everything in spherical symmetry. So the brain parenchyma is considered to be a thick spherical shell of poroelastic solid filled with incompressible fluid, that is CSF for now. The boundary conditions we want to use as they are in real life. So we assume a constant inflow into the ventricles, which is the production rate and our infusion rate, stress continuity at the ventricle wall, a given resistance to outflow, so the same outflow as in the other model, and the brain tissue is attached to the skull via dura mater and arachnoid, so we just assume the displacement to be 0 there. Now, the aqueduct would destroy our spherical symmetry, but we assume that it only has local influences, except for the flow that goes through. So we just also include it into the boundary conditions to not destroy the spherical symmetry, and that we have a magic sink and source at inside the ventricles and at the skull. Now comes physics. We assume linear elasticity so far, because it makes things easier to work with. And in spherical coordinates, that just means that the volumetric strain is of this form in terms of the displacement. Then Tizzardi's principle of effective stress tells us that we can decompose the total stress into the stress of the solid and the stress of the fluid, weighted with a parameter, the Beer-Willis parameter alpha, which basically tells us how saturated the matrix is with the fluid. In our cases, it's usually quite close to 1. Then linear elasticity, bar modulus times epsilon, and the stress of the fluid is just minus the pressure. It turns out that inertial terms are negligible, of the order of 10 to the minus 3 compared to 10 to the 4, so we can neglect them and just assume the stress to be divergence free, which, if you write everything out, gives us this equation k d epsilon dr minus alpha dp dr equals 0. The flux will come on the other one. We have 2 unknown functions, we have 1 equation so far, so we need another one. So we look at the increase of fluid content per reference volume. That is originally by Beer, who started whole proelasticity, find as zeta or theta or whatever we call it, but it is the change of fluid volume per reference volume. And it turns out that you can assume it to be linearly dependent on this volumetric stress, volumetric strain, and the pore pressure, so the fluid pressure, weighted with another parameter S. Furthermore, we assume Darcy flow through the porous medium, so that is flow is dependent on the pressure gradient with permeability K over viscosity mu. We do allow the permeability to depend on the strain. That is quite intuitive. When you compress the matrix, then you decrease the volume of the pores, so also the permeability should go down. Fluid volume balance, again, what's changing, the change of volume equals what's flowing in minus what's flowing out in this differential form. And putting those things together, we obtain our second equation, which now also includes time derivatives. So in total, those two equations form a system of differential algebraic equations. Especially if you discretize in space and then just consider it in time, then you have differential equations over here and algebraic equations here. Those are nasty to solve numerically. You can, in this case, do a bit of tweaking and just integrate the stress equation to get rid of the algebraic terms. But I'm not quite sure whether that would work if you consider nonlinear elasticity. So far, this makes our life a bit easier. Now, two fluids. We want to use a similar kind of equation. Sorry. So we include the information we get from arterial blood pressure into the same equation, pretty much. We assume that blood pressure does not vary spatially, or at least not too much, because the large arteries would transport the pressure quite quickly or instantly. So in the stress, we have again stress of the solid, stress of the CSF, and now also a term for the stress in the arterial blood, which is of a similar form as the one for the CSF. And the increase in CSF content then depends on the volumetric strain, the pressure in the CSF. So if you increase the CSF pressure, you force in more CSF, and a negative term for blood pressure, because if you increase the pressure in the arterial in blood, then you force out CSF. Putting this into our original equations, we get similar terms, just as we have these added terms with the arterial blood pressure, which don't go into the differential equations as such, because arterial blood pressure is known for us. Again, the same plot from the beginning in grey, and behind it I find a different simulation of these equations you've just seen. It looks okay, if you ask me. We get the average quite well. Also, if you split that up and look at the little window going over the time, 2 second window, and then average over this window and consider the amplitude in that window, it's not too bad, I'd say. Average, again, quite consistent in this case. I have to admit that we do play around with the parameters, of course, in this case, because we also have plots that look way out of things. The amplitude here, for example, you can see we don't... the black one is the simulation, so our amplitude gets too high. To see even more detail, we zoom in a bit more at two places, one before the infusion starts, 4 to 4.5 minutes, and one when the plateau is reached at 17 to 17 and a half minutes. And I'll show you little movies of that. Let's start in the middle. The red plot is the measured intracranial pressure. The blue plot is our simulation. Here, they look quite good. Average value is about the same. The form is similar, and we're also in phase. On the left, we have the displacement over the whole radius. We have these large negative displacements. Well, large. We have these quite big negative displacements, which probably mean that we just didn't get our initial conditions right yet, but that is something we can work on, we can tweak. And on the right, we see the increase in fluid content over the radius. You see this very steep increase at the ventricle wall, so we have boundary layers that are hard to capture with numerics, so we have to be extra careful about those. Is it fun? Fun? Oh, I'm fine. I've got another movie. So here, when the pressure goes up, we're not as well with the average anymore, as you've seen before on the plot. The displacement increases. We have this little hill just after the ventricle wall. And what you can't quite see, unless you really compare the videos directly, also the increase in, well, the fluid content has gone up a bit. But we still have the boundary layers. I think it's how do I get these off? Okay. Conclusion. So we've seen in the compartment model we have a highly nonlinear relation between the model parameters and the form of the pressure curve. So only certain parameters can be fitted reliably to clinical data. Furthermore, this model doesn't have any spatial variation, so if we want to know anything about the stress in the brain tissue, we have to consider biomechanical models. We've seen that a parallactic model predicts reasonable values, at least qualitatively, due to the crude geometry. You wouldn't expect much more, to be honest. The other problem is that I said you can't just measure the physical parameters, but as we've seen earlier, it is quite hard. So that is also a problem of biomechanical models. I'm right now working on a finite element simulation of similar equations to be able to resolve those boundary layers a bit better. Also, one could still work on a multi-fluid model by including, for example, also venous blood into the picture in a similar manner. It works all the same. And of course, we have right now a set of 11 infusion tests. We can get more if we want to, and those have to be analyzed and compared to the simulation. Thank you.